Next, Monitor invites you to Meet the Press, America's press conference of the air and winner of every major award in its field. Our guest today is Mohammad Ayub Khan, President of Pakistan. We'll bring you today's program in a moment after this message.
This is Merrill Muller. As of now, this second man...
St. Louis Post-Dispatch. And now, Meet the Press. Today's guest on Meet the Press is Mohammad Ayub Khan, President of Pakistan. Our panel, Marquis Childs, St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Peter Lisagor, Chicago Daily News, Pauline Frederick, NBC News, and Lawrence E. Spivak. Ned Brooks will moderate.
Pakistan, with its population of 90 million people, has been described as this nation's foremost friend and ally in Asia. The importance of Pakistan is being underscored now in the struggle against communism by the official visit of President Mohammad Ayub Khan. He came to the United States asking for help to carry out his second five-year plan to increase food production, develop industry, raise living standards, and improve education. His government system, which he calls basic democracies, has attracted world attention. President Ayub is the former commander-in-chief of the Pakistan Army. In 1958, he led the Bloodless Revolution, which opened the way for his vast program of economic and social reform. And now we're ready to start the questions, Mr. Spivak.
Well, Mr. President, are you pleased with the results of your visit with President Kennedy?
Yes, I'm very pleased indeed.
Would you rate it as highly successful or successful?
Yes, I should regard it as highly successful.
What would you list as the major items that pleased you most?
What pleased me most was that the president was prepared to speak in a spirit of great friendliness and frankness. And he also let me speak to him in the same fashion. And in that spirit, we now know each other's stand on different matters. And the vast area of agreement amongst us over our mutual problems.
Mr. President, Newsweek magazine quoted you as saying before you left for Washington, and these were the words, "Can it be that the United States," this was a question you were supposed to have asked, "can it be that the United States is abandoning its good friends for people who may not prove such good friends?" What answer did you find to that question here in Washington?
I can't remember what exactly were the words I used when I questioned the Newsweek reporter, but I think I might have well have said words to that effect. I think it's quite clear now that nobody can give up its reliable friends, not in these troubled times. If any country does that, it does so. It does far more damage to its own cause than anybody else's cause. But there is a feeling, too, in the United States that people who are not their confirmed friends, they all have also got to do business with them. Point is, to what extent that business should go. That is a point over which different people have different ideas. From our point of view, by all means do business with such people, support them and assist them, provided they too are prepared to make some contribution towards the stability of the world, or anyhow, stability in the areas in which they live.
You are satisfied, though, that the United States is not abandoning Pakistan for others who may not be quite such good friends of ours.
I'm quite satisfied. I never personally had any doubts in my mind, although there were a lot of people in my country who had some doubts.
Mr. Lisagor.
Mr. President, your country and the United States are both members of the Southeast Asian Treaty Organization, and there was a good deal of worry discussion here about the possibility of CETO intervening in the Laos crisis. They did not. Nothing happened. Do you think that CETO treaty as now constituted can be an effective deterrent or defense against communist aggression in Southeast Asia?
Well, SEATO, as you know, consists of so many members. So many countries are members of that organization. And when problems arise in those regions, let's say in Southeast Asia, then every country looks at the problem far from its own, shall we say, national interest. It has been proved during the period of Laotian crisis that different countries have different views as to what should be done, how should be done, in what manner assistance should be given. SEATO, therefore, will always be slow, even if all the members did agree to a certain course of action. That course of action, for one thing, will be a matter of compromise often. It will probably be delayed, that action, and may not be sufficient. My own personal belief is that it might be a good thing to detach the Portugal countries in the SEATO area so that the United States government has direct dealing with them, as you have in any case now, and that will give your government far greater flexibility.
In other words, you think that Laos and Cambodia and Vietnam should be detached and made a kind of American responsibility.
Well, a bilateral of some sort between you and them.
Mr. President, do you think that what happened in Laos is likely to encourage communist-inspired and communist-directed aggressions in other countries, neighboring countries in Southeast Asia?
I have no doubt in my mind that wherever they can find the opportunity to go and support subversion or support disruption, they will not hesitate to do so.
Could I ask you another question? As a military man, do you think an intervention in Laos would have been effective, would have achieved anything?
Well, that's a very debatable point. Different people have different views. Intervention could only be on behalf of someone who could hold that situation. I can see that there's a great difficulty in trying to find some such person who has the necessary determination and the support of the people. That's a very vital thing, too. Because even if SEATO forces went in, clear the country of communists, then who was going to hold that country free and clear?
Mr. President, many people in this country feel that the People's Republic of China would be a greater threat to the peace if the United States were to recognize it and it were to belong to the United Nations or be represented in the United Nations. Would you agree with them?
Well, I know in United States there's a tremendous feeling, emotional feeling on this problem of China. Your people have had long connections with China, and I know they are feeling frustrated and so on. If, looking at it purely rationally, I think Red China should be admitted to United Nations. But that doesn't entirely satisfy people who look at it from purely emotional angle. I can see that in the next General Assembly, the vote for putting the Chinese question on the list for consideration will probably be favorable to China. And I would beg people in America to have a united view, because any division in public opinion in America at this stage, when so many things, dangerous things are boiling up, will be extremely dangerous.
Even if that united view is opposed to having the People's Republic of China represented in the United Nations?
Well, I say that if, for instance, whatever view you have, do see that as many of you as possible support it.
Mr. President, you have indicated you believe that this subject will be discussed in the coming General Assembly. Do you think that there will be a vote in favor of representation of Red China in the coming Assembly?
That is what the assessment of a large number of people is. You notice that in the last General Assembly, when the vote was taken on this, I believe the motion was defeated by about 3 or 4 votes. And some 20 members of United Nations abstain. That may not obtain next time.
May I ask you this further question? That raises the problem of what to do about the nationalist Chinese. Have you any suggestions on that subject?
I really can't offer any ready hand solution. The problem is bedeviled by this, by the claims of both sides. Chiang Kai-shek claims that the Formosa is not the only country that that the nationalist Chinese own. The whole of mainland of China is theirs too. Whereas the communist Chinese also say, Formosa is ours, and that we shall not be. We shall not sit in United Nations if the nationalist Chinese are sitting there. If common sense was to prevail, and there was some give and take and so on and so forth, I suppose some formula to accommodate both perhaps could be found.
You mean negotiation between the two?
Well, negotiation for their positions in the United Nations, I'm talking.
Would Pakistan be willing to offer its good offices toward that end?
Well, Pakistan has got so many other problems to deal with, I think we will let other busybodies handle such problems.
Mr. Childs.
Mr. President, how far do you think that President Kennedy can go in persuading Prime Minister Nehru to mediate in the dispute between Pakistan and India over the province of Kashmir?
Well, we'll see how far he can go. He should be able to go a long way.
Did you discuss this with him now in your visit in Washington?
Yes, I did.
And did he agree to mediate?
Yes, he did. Well, he agreed to certainly raise this point with him and impress on him the necessity of resolution of this problem. Because unless Kashmir is resolved, the present situation, which is that the Indian Army and Pakistan Army are facing each other, will stay. And if that stays, now all sorts of dangerous consequences can follow, which I have described several times before. And so that situation is not only dangerous for India and Pakistan, but it's dangerous for your interests, too.
I know how strongly you feel about this, Mr. President. Would you, in your opinion, would President Kennedy be well advised if Prime Minister Nehru refused to mediate or allow him to be the mediator to cut off aid to India of any kind?
Now that's something that is very difficult to answer. But let's look at the philosophy of this aid. You are giving this enormous, massive aid to India for a certain purpose. The purpose is to bring an area of stability, create an area of stability in those regions. Well, if you're doing that, then there is some obligation on Mr. Nehru, too, to respond with responsibility. And help to resolve such problems that militate against achievement of that objective. So you have every right to say, look, what good can our aid do whilst these situations last between India and Pakistan?
What if in an objective mediation, whether by President Kennedy or by some of his advisors, the decision went against Pakistan, and Kashmir was ruled to be part of India, would you feel compelled to accept that decision, Mr. President?
Well, the basic thing is that Kashmir belongs to the people of Kashmir. If the people of Kashmir said, they didn't want to be with Pakistan, then we have no reason to urge them to be with Pakistan. What we want is that they should get freedom.
But you would be quite willing to submit to an impartial mediation, is that correct?
Let us say after that mediation has found out the feelings of the people. Yes? Well, why not?
Mr. Spivak.
Mr. President, can you tell us now what position Pakistan will take in the United Nations on the question of admitting communist China?
You know that we have recognized communist China. We have an embassy in Peking. They have an embassy in Karachi. They are our neighbors. We have been feeling that they should be admitted in United Nations. I know that's sometimes is contradictory to the feelings of people here. But it can't do any harm. Anyhow, the present situation is anomalous.
Does that mean then that Pakistan will vote for admission if
it
the question
like
comes
it,
up?
Yes, yes.
It is likely, you
yes,
say.
Yes.
Is it certain?
Well, I think it's almost certain, yes.
Red China has been a troublemaker outside of the UN. What do you expect is going to be gained by admitting her to the UN?
Well, you can certainly tell them that this is the sort of trouble they're making, isn't it? If people think that they are troublemakers. Whereas, if you haven't got the opportunity to confront them, then you deny yourself even the right of doing that much.
Well, don't you think we have already told them that in many ways?
Well, that's only indirect, isn't it? Over a distance of some, 15,000 miles?
You think if you admit them into the United Nations that you're going to have less trouble? We've had the Russians in there now for some years, and they certainly have caused enough trouble both in and outside the United Nations. What then is to be gained?
Well, just imagine what would have happened if the Russians were not members of the United Nations. You think that that would have reduced their ability to create trouble? Maybe that they would have embarked on far greater amount of, lack of knowledge of the other people. They might have done all sorts of things.
Mr. President, do you think that China, Red China, should also be admitted to the disarmament talks on the theory that sooner or later they will have atomic weapons?
Well, all I can say is that if disarmament is to come ever, which I doubt, then I think any country like China will undoubtedly have to be a party and a member to such a transaction.
Mr. President, I'd like to ask you one question on Prime Minister Nehru, which you may or may not feel you can answer. There are a great many people in this country, and I think in Europe too, who feel that Mr. Nehru was one of the great influences for peace in the world. What is the attitude in Asia on that, in your area of Asia?
He's not been instrumental in bringing about peace in the area in which he lives, and we live next door to him.
Mr. Lissagor.
Mr. President, the Russians seem to have been more active in Laos than the Chinese communists, at least insofar as supplying military aid. Why do you think this is so?
It's quite a riddle, really. One can't understand it. Maybe that the Chinese haven't got the means, I suppose.
Do you think that the Russians and the Chinese have divided up areas in Asia, Southeast Asia, or the world for that matter, between themselves as to which will have the influence in this or that area?
It doesn't look apparent, because in that case the Russians wouldn't have been supporting the Laotian struggle, would they?
The theory had been offered that the Russians were in Laos as a moderating influence to prevent the Chinese communists from coming in there and starting a full-scale war going to the West. Would you subscribe to that?
Well, if the Chinese disagreed with that, they could have stopped the Russians coming in, couldn't they? They come in through North Vietnam, through Hanoi. I think the Chinese had the power to stop them if...
Mr. President, I'd like to ask you a broader question about the whole of the Southeast Asian area. They're the victims of indirect aggression there now, infiltration and subversion. There is no clear-cut crossing of borders and so on. Can the free nations of South Asia and Southeast Asia, plus the West, cope with this? What can you do about it to prevent
it? Yes, I think fundamentally it's like this, that if there is identification between the rulers of these countries and the people, identification of interest, then it becomes possible to defend an area. Then people are interested in defending it. But if the rulers are just interested in preservation of their privileges and so on and so forth, which often are at the cost of the people's interest, then it becomes exceedingly difficult problem.
Well, is it your view then that this area is of the kind that where rulers do not identify themselves with
well,
the
Well, I don't know to what extent they do, but I think they ought to. And the meaning of that is that they ought to carry out major basic social reforms, like land reforms, bringing in more education, giving people more hand in the running of their country, and so on.
Miss Frederick.
Mr. President, we've been hearing a great deal of ominous talk between the East and West. By that I mean particularly between the United States and the Soviet Union over their differences, over Berlin and other places. We've been hearing veiled hints that there might be military action. Each has stepped up its military budget so that each is spending more than 40% of its budget on weapons and military preparation. Two questions. Is a nuclear war realistic in this day and age? If not, is this just bluffing on either side? Secondly, how does a smaller nation, which does not have such weapons, feel when it's sort of caught in between these two competing big powers?
Well, I'll answer your question in two parts. First of all, what you're trying to say is this, that now that the nuclear weapons and thermonuclear weapons have been developed, do I think that the war is now out of question? My belief is it doesn't matter what type of weapons exist, human beings will still fight each other. If you disarm the whole world today, they'll fight with their fists, I think. Until such time that the world law-maintaining authority is established. Until you have some sort of world confederation or federation, a world government coming into the world. I don't know whether mankind will move fast enough towards that direction. If it did, it could avoid the Third World War. If it didn't, you could have disarmament tomorrow. People talk about disarmament. Well, even if you have disarmament, you find the suspicions will still stay. Some weapons will still remain hidden. One nation will not trust another nation. And war could still start, perhaps even with bows and arrows and so on. And the only preventive to that is a body that can maintain law and order amongst the human race. I would like to submit that the effort should not be so much on bringing about disarmament, but bringing about a common form of government in which the whole human race has a faith. Of course, unfortunately, you come up against this problem. The communists say, well, we are offering you a patron. If you accept this, all this struggle is over. The rest of mankind is perhaps not prepared to accept that as the correct patron.
We have about 2.5 minutes. Mr. Childs.
You've said, Mr. President, several times that you hoped the United States would come up with a method to control the birth rate in your country to prevent the increasing population explosion in Pakistan. Did you take this subject up with the president and his advisors?
I forgot to really, quite frankly. We had so many other things to discuss. But this is a thing which is very, very serious for us, and for all of you, perhaps. I know in the United States there is a feeling that there is a religious feeling against this sort of thing. I know your Catholic Christians don't believe in this sort of business. I know in our religion, too, there is a certain amount of inhibition against it. And so government doesn't want to get involved. But I personally think that people should see ahead a bit. And you have the scientific knowledge, the technical know-how, and the means and for necessary research. And I think unless some sort of pill or some sort of drug or injection is produced which can neutralize a person with one shot, there will be no real answer to this thing. And I think the quicker this is realized here in the United States, the quicker we will find the answer.
Because you add each year about 2 million new mouths to feed, isn't that not correct?
That's
and you have
true.
Said, sir, that you have to run very fast just to stand still.
That's quite true. Quite true.
Even with all the aid you might get from outside.
That's quite true. That's quite true.
1.5 million tons of food you need from outside each year, is that correct?
Yeah.
Mr. Spivak.
Mr. President, you've indicated that Pakistan is not quite satisfied with the amount of aid you've been getting from the West. Can you give us some idea what you would consider adequate?
Well, I think when we talked about inadequacy, we probably were referring to the last consortium meeting that was held here in Washington under the auspices of World Bank. We were looking for resources for our 2 years of our 5-year plan. And on that, there were arguments this way and that way. And we were given 1/3 of the amount, or offered 1/3 of the amount that we require.
I'm very sorry, but I'm going to have to interrupt at this time. I see that our time is up.
Thank you, Ned Brooks. We'll tell you about next week's guest on Meet the Press in just a moment. Parents should observe the following rules before leaving their children in the care of a babysitter. Anticipate an emergency. Write down the telephone numbers of the fire department and police department, your family doctor, and the number at which you can be reached. Show the sitter how to lock and unlock all tricky doors and windows. Explain how to operate the stove. Point out the location of first aid supplies. Also, strongly impress upon your sitter these vital instructions. In case of fire, first get everyone out of the house and then call the fire department. When employing a babysitter, guide yourself by following these suggestions. Choose someone who has a knowledge of first aid, one who will use common sense and not allow the children to play with matches, electric appliances, or attachments, one who thoroughly understands the danger of fire and the necessity of getting the children out of the house immediately should fire happen to strike.
Day to remember, July 1945. The United States flag is raised over Berlin as the first American troops participate in the occupation government. Another July, 16 years later, Berlin is again in the spotlight, a focal point in the Cold War. This is Chet Huntley reminding summertime travelers to stay well informed on the Berlin crisis and with fast-changing events elsewhere in the world by keeping your car radio or portable tuned to NBC Radio News on the Hour.